The headlines: Israel is stepping up its crackdown on Palestinians following Friday's retaliatory attacks in occupied Al-Quds. For the fourth consecutive week, Tel Aviv witnesses a massive rally against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his policies. And amid protests in the U.S. city of Memphis, authorities disband a special police unit whose officers fatally beat a young black man. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Israel is taking a range of escalatory measures in response to the shooting attacks in occupied Al-Quds. Those include making it easier for Israelis to obtain gun permits and encouraging those with licenses to carry their weapons. The regime also said it will demolish the homes of suspected Palestinian attackers and revoke certain rights of their families, including their social security benefits. Israel has also promised new steps to expand illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military is also sending more troops into occupied Al-Quds. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had earlier pledged a, quote, strong, swift, and precise response to the deadly shooting attacks. He said the regime is prepared for any scenario. Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian man near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. A man was shot dead near the Kedemim settlement in Akalika. Israel claims that the Palestinian was in possession of a gun and suspicious of carrying out a shooting operation. This as Israeli troops are on alert following two shooting operations in occupied Al-Quds. The first incident happened on Friday when a Palestinian man killed seven settlers near a synagogue there. The second happened on Saturday when a 13-year-old Palestinian boy injured two Israelis. The incidents followed an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank that claimed the lives of nine Palestinians. Wafa al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist, is joining us live from Gaza City to discuss that further. Thank you very much, Ms. Udaini. If you could please elaborate more on these attacks on Palestinians that have intensified, especially since Benjamin Netanyahu has been in office.
Yeah, well, the resistance operation in occupied Jerusalem, it didn't came from nowhere, but rather it came in retaliation to what happened in Jenin and to what happened in a daily basis in occupied Palestine in all cities from the Israeli occupation. And indeed, this thing, because, you know, Palestinians have been witnessing oppression and degradation and apartheid, genocide, since long, long years from the occupation. So what is happening from the resistance operation is a normal response from the people who experience this oppression for long decades so far. And indeed, this resistance operation in occupied Jerusalem, indeed, it has two messages. The first message is for the new Israeli government, who, since they came to office, indeed, they direct their attacks against Palestinians. So it becomes like a daily basis. You find Palestinians, you find the Israeli occupation, raided the prison, the occupation of prisons, assaulted the prisoners, and even raided the cities in occupied West Bank. And actually, the second message for this resistance operation is for those who worked so hard for long years to whitewash the young generation memory, because you know that they said when they occupied Palestine, they said that the old will die and the young will forget. But what happened indeed, because you know that those who actually made the resistance operation, their ages are from 18 to 22. And those are from the young generation who they worked so hard, you know, to erase their memory, to whitewash their memory, that this is that they are not the indigenous people of Palestine, and they do not have any right in this land, and Israel is a democratic state, and so on. So indeed, these two operations, two resistance operation. Operations indeed. So it is a clear message to those who actually exert so much effort to erase the Palestinian memory. So indeed, those people, they know their right, they know their land, and they know that they have the whole right to resist the occupation. And for those who think that Palestinians kill, you know, Israeli civilians, for your information, none of the Israelis are civilian. They are all armed and armed to teeth. They are they all have weapons, you know, to defend themselves. But for Palestinians, for example, who are in Jerusalem, you know, they don't have the right to even hold a weapon or to hold any kind of arms. And if they find anyone has a weapon, they completely, you know, attack him and detain him for having such arm. So that's why we recently see some Palestinians, whenever they want to confront and to retaliate to the occupation operation, they just use the knives, because you know that this is the only thing that they have to defend themselves and to defend their people.
Thank you very much, Wafa Al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist, joining us live from Gaza City. Esha Krishnaway, podcaster and journalist, is also joining us live from St. Petersburg. I would like to have your opinion, ma'am, also regarding the escalated violence on the part of Israelis against Palestinians.
It is clear that it's because of Netanyahu's new government, and one of the election promises or election campaigns is expanded. They were going to have expanded land or expanded houses for settlers. And to me, what is most stark and striking is that yesterday the Israeli parliament government announced easing of gun restrictions for settlers as a way of encouraging vigilante terrorism or even just outright violence against Palestinians. And another thing that is extremely disturbing is that the Israeli government has said that they were going to take retaliatory measures against families of known terrorists, which is very vague, and it could mean anything, literally. It could mean, I mean, it could just mean somebody who lives in the wrong house to somebody who's actually done a terrorist attack, because of the way the laws are, the way the laws are very, very vague and open to interpretation. And it seems to make it much harder for Palestinians to live in what they call the disputed territories. Of course, way they raided the camps in Jenin reminds me of what happened in 2002, where Israel ended up destroying about one third of the infrastructure in the camp and also many of the houses there, in order to make room for new settler incursions, in my opinion.
Thank you very much, Esha Krishnaway, podcaster and journalist, joining us live from St. Petersburg. Moving on, tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets of Tel Aviv for the fourth consecutive week to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's judicial reforms. Protesters chanted slogans and held banners depicting Netanyahu and his ministers. They expressed their disapproval of what they call a fascist cabinet and its proposed reforms meant to increase political power. The Israeli cabinet says the reforms are needed to curb the overreach by activist judges that has drawn fierce opposition from groups, including lawyers. Netanyahu returned to power as the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. The cabinet is planning to hand over more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding the rulings of the regime's apex court. The coalition also intends to intensify the expansionist policy with more settlement units in the occupied West Bank. Iran's defense ministry says it has repelled a drone attack on one of its workshops in central Iran. In a statement, the ministry said the workshop located in the central city of Isfahan came under attack by three mini-drones. It says one of the drones was hit by the air defense and the other two were caught in defense traps and blew up. It added that the unsuccessful attack did not cause any loss of life and caused minor damage to the workshop's roof. The ministry noted the attack also did not cause any disruption in the workshop's operations. Iran's presence says friendly relations between Tehran and Baku have been the base of strong cultural and historical ties. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with his Azeri counterpart Ilham Aliyev. Raisi said the governments in Tehran and Baku will not allow ill-wishers to exploit friendly relations between the two countries. He was referring to a recent incident at the embassy of Azerbaijan Republic in Tehran, which resulted in the death of one Azeri diplomat. The president expressed his deepest condolences over the matter, noting that the relevant authorities are following up on the case. For his part, Aliyev said that the Friday incident was an unprecedented attack. He stressed that the Republic of Azerbaijan will not allow for the disruption of Baku-Tehran relations under the pretext of such incidents. The U.S. city of Memphis has disbanded the special police unit whose officers fatally beat a young man. Memphis Police Department said it was the best and in the best interest of all to permanently deactivate that unit. That came after protesters took to the streets in Memphis and other cities. They demanded justice for the death of Tyre Nicholas after a video was released showing police violently arresting that black young man. He died just a few days later from this incident. Five officers involved in this incident have been charged with murder, assault, and kidnapping, amongst other charges. Police brutality against people of color has been a major source of public outcry in the U.S. This issue was most prominently thrown into the spotlight after the police killing of George Floyd in 2020. Our correspondent in Washington, Colin Campbell, tells us more about the growing outrage in the U.S. over police brutality, especially against minorities.
You are now hearing more calls for police reforms, for police culture to change, for the pathology to be diminished of these teams of police officers that seem to operate above the law. We do know that this Scorpion unit, the elite teams unit that was part of the police force that actually encountered Nichols, has now been disbanded. And this was about four teams of 10 police officers each that were specialized in auto theft incidents, high crime incidents, drugs, things like that. These teams have been disbanded. Now, what does that mean as far as the implications for crime in Memphis, where crime can be high? I think a lot of people are questioning that now. However, this also helps to diminish some of the anger coming from the community, because it does seem like the police department is doing something about it.
At least one protester has been killed in the Peruvian capital, Lima, as anti-government protesters clash with security forces. Angry protesters hurled projectiles at the riot police, who responded by firing tear gas and stones. The latest death brings to nearly 60 the number of people killed in Peru's unrest. The country has been mired in political crisis after the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo in December. He is now in pretrial detention over attempts to dissolve Congress. Since then, his supporters have been protesting across the country. They demand the release of the president, and they also demand his successor, Dina Boluarte, to step down and early elections to be held. However, Peru's Congress has turned down Boluarte's request to advance the polls from the previously scheduled 2026 to 2024 and even earlier to the end of this year. Following a week of desecration of the Holy Quran in the Netherlands, Sweden, the UK Muslims have joined global protests to vent their anger and hurt. Sweden's embassy in London was the location targeted for most of the demonstrations, which saw Muslims burning flags and reciting Quran verses.
Hundreds of angered Muslim protesters converged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent desecration of Islam's holy book. Protesters came from across the UK in order to make their upset clear and to pressure European governments to take anti-Muslim hate more seriously.
This is the latest example of a protest to take place as anger across the Muslim world remains incredibly high. This week alone, there have been numerous Quran-burning protests and promises by right-wing activists to continue the pressure. As the protests continue, the anger will continue to grow too.
We live for Quran. The Quran is very respectful. The Holy Quran is not our word, not our book. It's the book from Allah, then has to be very respectful.
This should stop because this is our human right, as well as the European laws. As we are living in European continent, the European law states that every religion and their religious leadership must be respected.
On Monday, a Dutch politician tore apart a copy of the Holy Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed an incident in Sweden where a politician burned a copy of the Quran outside the Turkish embassy. These extremists have been receiving authorities' permission to conduct the heinous acts, even provided police protection under the guise of freedom of expression. Mosques, Muslim-strong residential areas, and embassies belonging to Muslim countries have all been the target of these Islamophobic incidents. This blatant state facilitation of anti-Islam extremism has led many Muslims to feel vulnerable in a continent which claims to defend minority and religious rights. Robert Carter, London.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
temperature.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we looked into the adverse effects and potential dangers of psychotropic drugs. We went to France, the number one user of such medication, to see how psychotropic drugs prescribed much too readily and in a cocktail to cure feelings of anxiety and depression have in some cases led to madness, suicide, extreme acts of violence, and murder. Yet the root cause of the extensive use of such drugs seems to be much more than naive and ignorant doctors and desperate patients, especially when a multi-million dollar industry is at stake. Stay with us for the rest of the documentary.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No. I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question. Okay, well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer. This is what Michael Baum denounces, a lawyer specializing in the pharmaceutical industry. This man is a nightmare for the laboratories. His trials have cost them billions of dollars. His theme, denouncing the addictive effects of medication.
One of the issues with these drugs is once you're on, you can't get off. They become a captive audience. And they get trained, basically, the patients get trained to stay on it. It's if they take the drug and then stop the drug, they start experiencing these brain zaps, or they start experiencing these nausea symptoms or these severe headaches or dizziness. And then they take the drug, they take it back, they go back on it, and it goes away. Well, they get reinforced with the concept of, I need to stay on it. And they think that maybe, and what doctors used to think, was that they were relapsing back into their depression. That isn't what was happening at all.
The dangers of psychotropic drugs have been well known for a long time. Since September 1991, the American Medication Agency has had to react against waves of complaints against Prozac, the grandfather of modern antidepressants. This drug has been blamed for hundreds of suicides and murders, and administration officials are getting together to determine whether a correlation exists between Prozac and acts of violence. In front of this committee of reputed psychiatrists are the families of victims.
My husband didn't believe me. He was a pharmacist. We came back, and on April 30, he just blew his brains out in front of all of us. How many more have to die before somebody looks? If we made a mistake, we're humans.
After being on Prozac for 21 days, my wife shot and killed both of these two boys right here. She turned the gun to herself and shot herself twice. I heard these people talking about scientific data. For those that don't say we have scientific data.
I entered
therapy 1 year ago as a victim of rape. I stand before you today a victim of Prozac. It baffles my mind to think that a prescription drug I could simply compare to a felony of rape. But yes, they can be compared, because if a drug robs you of your will to live, then it has committed a felony equal to that of rape.
She shot herself on the head.
This was the date of my first...
For a whole day, witnesses will make statements. It's overwhelming.
I firmly believe the drug...
The internist...
How many more people are going to be killed and maimed before you do something? You have the power to change things. You have the power to listen to what we say and investigate what we say. We need help.
Following the statements, the committee votes.
There is credible evidence to support a conclusion that antidepressant drugs cause the emergence and or intensification of suicidality and or other violent behaviors. Those in favor of that statement vote yes. Those opposed to that statement, no.
There is total surprise. Unanimously, the committee declares that there is no link between Prozac and the violence described by the families of the victims.
Vote on the following statement.
Jeffrey Lieberman is a member of the committee. Later, he goes on to be the all-powerful president of the American Psychiatric Association. And of the 10 psychiatrists present during the vote, 9 of them had conflicts of interest with one or several pharmaceutical companies. When Prozac was launched, the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company worked very hard. But one of the board directors even denounced the methods he had himself used to boost sales of the drug. He is John Virapen, and he was director of Lilly in Sweden until 1988. And it's not his style to beat around the bush.
We're not patients, we're consumers. And we're being ripped off right, left, and center. And unfortunately, as I see it today, the drug companies have the power, total power. They are in all corners of the industrial complex. They're in there somewhere doing dirty work.
And you were a part of it.
And I was a part. That's why I'm able to tell you all of this. I was a part of it. I've done, my hands are dirty. I'm trying to clean now. It's redemption time.
It's time for redemption. And John Virapen has written a book with a provocative title, Side Effects, Death. Notably, it discusses the way in which he was asked to conceal side effects.
The doctors prescribe to the patient, but don't tell them anything because they don't know. They rely completely on what the pharma industry tells them. These little salesmen that run around, I was a salesman too. And they used to instruct me when I was a salesman. The first thing is, you don't talk side effects with doctors.
Why do they do that? Because they want to make money, 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 money. They don't care about your lives. They only care about their wallets.
From conferences to interviews, John Virapen does not hesitate to reveal what he implemented to encourage sales, corruption, gifts, and trips.
To children. General practitioners, they don't usually get to go to big Congress and World Congress here and there. So one day I got the idea that maybe we should do something with these guys. So I gathered a whole bunch of them and took them to Singapore. Fly them down to Singapore and gave them the works. I mean, it was exclusive. When they came back, my sales escalated.
In light of these accusations, Lilly, the lab that created Prozac, did not wish to meet with us. But this is what they said by email. John Virapen has not been employed by Lilly since 1988. He therefore cannot be considered as a credible source of information concerning the current activities of the group, its motives, or practices. The Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, like all the others, nevertheless fought hard so that the American administration did not impose a black box warning on antidepressant leaflets, an explicit caution against the risks of suicide or violent behavior. But in 2004, finally, it became a done deal. This victory is owed to the activism of victims' families and their lawyers, such as Andy Vickery. The pharmaceutical industry also has a bone to pick with this Texan. He also received billions in compensation during the famous arrangements whereby laboratories preferred to pay out rather than stand trial. To better explain how a pill can kill, he makes use of a puzzle. His demonstration, he claims, applies for all psychotropic drugs.
Is there a phenomenon, a distinct phenomenon, of Prozac-induced suicide? The first attribute is the patients became suddenly suicidal. People who've never thought of killing themselves, of harming themselves, take one of these drugs, whoom, they go instantly from that feeling to death. The second piece of the puzzle was that the suicides were all violent. I've shared with you already the story of Pat Williamson. She was on Prozac 9 days when she came in one morning to her husband and said, "Honey, would you show me how to kill myself?" And her husband said, "Oh, Pat, please." And he decides to go check up on her after 15 or 20 minutes and finds that she has made 100 mutilating cuts in her body. The third piece of the puzzle that Eli Lilly noticed was an obsessive quality to the act. It's just this sudden impulse to do something really violent, really dangerous to themselves or others. And it's just, they're just overwhelmed by it. They're obsessed with the idea. And they cannot control their behavior. In the period of time between the person starts to take the drug and the time of their death or suicide attempt, that there's abnormal behavior. Something different is going on. And sometimes the medical help is, "Oh, you just need to take more of this drug. Let's increase your dose." It's like, "Oh, there's a little fire. Let's pour some gasoline on it." And the final piece of the puzzle is, almost all of the cases that I have handled, the death has happened within 30 days of the time the person either started the drug or had their dose increase.
Once again, Lilly Laboratory only answers our accusations by mail. They explain that one of the most striking studies in the last few years shows that there is a decrease in suicide, -32%, and in mortality, -49%, when depressed patients take antidepressants. But what is the truth? This study is contested by other studies that claim the contrary. And if in the United States, thousands of victims came to the forefront, then why would France be spared, the leading consumer worldwide of psychotropic drugs? In April 2014, a court trial would clarify the current state of affairs in an enlightening manner. Back in December 2008, Jean is depressed. He struggles to deal with his professional life, and at the birth of his son, he attempts suicide. He therefore went to the psychiatrist, Dr. Gossares. The doctor recommends that he try out a new antidepressant, which was not yet available on the market, Brintellix. Jean did not react to the treatment. The psychiatrist proposed to double the dosage. A few days later, Jean set himself on fire. Corinne, Jean's wife, refused to believe that it was a random suicide. She alerted the authorities, and Dr. Gossares was put under inspection on 7 charges. He was accused of embezzlement, but worse, putting others' lives in danger for at least 8 patients, including Jean, Corinne's husband. On April 30th, 2014, the doctor was strangely judged in Bordeaux, the court where he himself was a judiciary expert. He received a suspended sentence of 6 months that he appealed. But why would the pharmaceutical company Lundbeck, the creators of the antidepressants, not be investigated themselves? The pharmaceutical company Lundbeck has no interest in this affair going public. They've invested millions in order to get Brintellix approved by medical authorities. However, Jean was not at all the same since his dosage of Brintellix was raised, as described by Corinne and her mother. For Lundbeck, it is therefore not Brintellix that is to blame, but Jean's depression. It's a credible defense, which is used by all pharmaceutical companies when they are blamed. However, we also met with other victims of this trial period, and bizarrely, they all described the same symptoms. Such as Christian Mounier, who also tested Brintellix for 8 months. Since, he has lost his job, his memory, and he describes himself as a vegetable. A man who is no longer himself, another who commits suicide, apparently devastating side effects for 8 sufferers. But there was also the suicide of 2 more patients just after coming off Brintellix. This bad streak should have alerted the authorities. However, nothing would come of it, as on the same day as Jean's self-immolation, Dr. Gosseres wiped his name from the file. His death was therefore no longer related to the clinical tests. The medical authorities explained to us that for each test of a drug, they only receive the results achieved across the whole territory. The botched trials of Dr. Gosseres were therefore lost in the mass and mixed with several other accepted studies across the world, as this document shows that makes Brintellix's market release official. Lundbeck throws the blame back to the public health authorities. So what can be said of the package insert that we found in the United States, where Brintellix has been approved since 2013? Side effects are documented in 2 whole pages. Especially, though, the principal paragraph warns against the raised risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's the famous black box warning. In other words, the highest alert level. In France, Brintellix has just been approved for sale on the market. It has therefore been judged as useful in fighting depression. The doors are slammed shut. Jean is responsible for his own atrocious suicide. Just like the death of Mark, Aurélie's murderous thoughts and suicide attempt, or the fall of Christian Mounier. If the effectiveness of such medication on most serious depressive states cannot be denied, how many more tragedies need to occur before the effects of psychotropic drugs on some patients are truly recognized?
Seems that as long as money and power are involved in the realm of healthcare, pills that are expected to cure depression actually cause suicide and murder. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, we are social beings. We live in the society. We need to have interaction with each other. We need to have give and take relationship with each other. And we need to build trust and confidence in society in order to lead or to live a happy life and a better life. Without trust, we cannot achieve comfort. Without trust, without positive thinking, and without a pessimistic view, we are not going to have peace of mind, we are not going to have tranquility, and we are not going to have comfort. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam said, "Trust is a comfort to the heart and security in faith." Now, in fact, trust also releases the pressure created by the miseries and misfortunes of life. In our daily life, in our day-to-day life, we encounter a lot of difficulties and hardships. in our life as a result of the incidents or the catastrophes that take place. So mishaps are there everywhere. We have difficult lives. And the difficulties of life and the pressures that we suffer will be reduced to a large extent by having trust. Trust in God and trust in our friends and the people around us. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says in his Ghurar al-Hakam, trust reduces depression. Now, depression is due to a lack of trust and confidence. Because of a lack of trust, we begin to experience depression, frustration, hopelessness, disappointment. And all these are as a lack of trust. Trust also means, you know, consigning your matters to God, to Allah, the Almighty. You know, when something happens, you should trust Allah. You should consign your matters to Allah. And that's when you will feel less depression. You will feel less disappointed and less desperate. There is not a thing that makes life more beautiful in our eyes, reduces our sufferings, and paves the way for success like optimism and trust do. Therefore, we need to be careful of painful thoughts. We need to be careful of hurtful thoughts, such as pessimism. Just as you are cautious of illnesses, you also need to be cautious of your thoughts. We need to open our minds to optimistic thinking. We need to understand how easily we can rescue ourselves from intrusive thoughts. You know, these intrusive thoughts keep hurting us. They are coming again and again, and we need to ignore those thoughts. We need to replace them with positive thinking, with optimistic thinking. Pessimism destroys our well-being, our spiritual and our mental well-being. It makes our life restless, and it makes our life full of trouble and full of uneasiness, full of apprehension, full of anxiety. So we should not pay heed and pay attention to such painful thoughts. We need to replace them with positive thinking. It is essential for Muslims to behave with each other in such a way that does not leave room for ill expectations. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand it crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, you know, used to advise Muslims to think positively about each other and not to act in a manner that would make others mistrust them. And he recommended the people to avoid places of suspicions, to avoid going to places where they are suspected of doing something wrong, you know. In his Nahj al-Balagha, in his short maxims or in his short sayings, saying number 341, Imam Ali alayhi says, "Man dakhala madakhil as-su'i uttuhim." Now, it means that a person who enters in places where he is suspected, then he is accused of doing something wrong. For example, if a Muslim goes to a bar where, okay, people usually go to drink wine, to drink alcoholic beverages, then obviously a Muslim person who even does not drink and who goes to such places, he will be suspected of drinking. While in fact he may not be doing this, but it's better, according to Imam Ali, it's better to avoid going to such places, even if one has an essential thing to do. So, madakhil as-su is bad. It's important that one should avoid going to such places. And Imam Ali has been quoted as saying, "He who holds hope in you has given you his trust. Therefore, do not disappoint him." Now, this means that when someone trusts you, you should not betray him. You should not disappoint him. You should fulfill his hope. And brothers and sisters, there are many, many sayings and many important traditions that have been reported from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and from the infallible imams about su'udhan, about suspicion, about pessimism, as well as about optimism. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has been reported to have said, "La yaglibanna alayka su'udhanni fa innahu la yada'u baynaka wa bayna khalilin sulha." You know, suspicion, according to this hadith, as I would like to translate it, but my translation is a rough translation of the hadith, "La yaglibanna alayka su'udhan." Su'udhan should not overwhelm you, because if it overwhelms you, la yada'u baynaka wa bayna khalilin sulha, it will not leave any room for any sulh, for any peace, or for any trust between you and your friend. Yes, if there is suspicion in your life, you will not be able to continue your friendship. There will be no room for any trust between you and your friend. That is for sure. And also there is a saying from Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, the 8th Shia Imam. He says, "A'lam anna al-jubna wal-bukhla wal-harsa gharizatun yajma'uha su'udhan." Verily, you should know that su'udhan is the source of cowardice, greediness, and stinginess. You know, when you are suspicious of your brothers, then you will have no room for generosity. There will be no room for interaction with your brothers in faith. You will not trust them. And also there is a saying from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, who says, "La deena li musi'il dhan." There is no religion for a person who suspects other people, for a person who is pessimistic towards other people. So, brothers and sisters, I would like to conclude that suspicion and pessimism towards other people will destroy trust and confidence. It will destroy peace of mind, and it will destroy comfort, tranquility, love, and everything. There will be no room left for any interaction, any trust. While we need trust in our life, we are social beings. We need trust one another, and we need to assume that our brothers in faith are doing good, and that they do not do with their actions, they do not mean to hurt us, to cause any harm. We need to trust others, otherwise we will not live a life of comfort and a life full of tranquility and peace of mind. That is the end of this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.